Okay, so we've now fulfilled the legal requirements. Welcome. It's wonderful to have you here. And it's my real pleasure to introduce to you Gabe Brostow. Many of you know him already. He's a long-term collaborator here at the lab and co-supervisor of many PhD students. There have been a fair number of interns, including one in the audience, I believe. Already, Stefan, who's sitting in the back. So obviously we know Gabe, he's a friend of the lab, and it's a real pleasure to have him here today to talk to us about predicting 3D volume and stereo, for volume and depth from a single view sometimes. So thank you very much, and please welcome Gabe Brostow.
Thank you, Matthew. Wonderful introduction, and hello to all of you. Thank you for coming over. Really, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. So I'm going to talk about turning a single image into either a depth or a volume. And so that means I'm not going to talk about harmonic networks, because if I did, then you would realize that you're using convolutional neural networks incorrectly. And you wouldn't like that. You wouldn't want to know that, you know, instead of using these kinds of kernels, you should be using these kind of circular harmonic kernels. If you were using our kinds of kernels, you would get rotational equivariance, where equivarience is already baked into neural networks for translation. So if you have different input images, so here the image is just being translated, in feature space, the different inputs actually look very similar to each other. They are just translated versions. And if you stabilize some portion of that, you'll see that this isn't changing, even though the inputs are changing. So this is great because it means that if you're doing tracking, you can still monitor the motion of an object. But when you're doing recognition, the object isn't changing. That's not true for rotation. See, here, when we rotate, the feature space representation is changing. And that's not great because that means that if I show you a dog and a rotated dog in feature space, it looks like two very different things. Now, lots of people have tried to deal with that and tried to work around it, but the work we've done, which I'm not telling you about, is how through harmonic networks, we're able to give you rotational equivariance. And so what you're getting is, after you stabilize, in feature space, you get this representation, which if you compare to sort of the native CNN representation, you should see is actually quite stable. So showing you an image, rotated version of the image, it doesn't matter. It still looks pretty much the same in feature space. You have the invariant part and the kind of covariant part. Yes?
Quick question. Can you deal with both rotation and translation?
The translation part is already present in CNNs, and you don't lose that. Although you do sacrifice a very little bit because of our constraining to those kinds of filters. So you still have rotation, you have translation, you now have rotation. There's a small penalty you pay for it.
But you're not talking about that.
But I'm not talking about that. And one of the reasons I'm not talking about it is because this is a picture of my team from last year, so this is sort of at our peak. As mentioned, you have Stefan here in the audience, so he's a brilliant PhD student and interning here for the summer. And he is the co-author of this work and can tell you in great detail a lot more specifics about it. And this is and they're presenting this. He's presenting this at CVPR this summer. These are the co-authors on that paper. Besides Stefan's work, which I'm not talking about today, I will focus on the work by Michael Furman on the right and Clément Godard in the middle. Both of them. Supported by Oisin McKay. And for the two projects I'm going to talk about, first the first one and then the second, we're converting a single image into something quite cool. So in the first instance, it's converting a single depth image, like from a Kinect, into a volume. And then we'll convert a single color image into a depth. I'm not going to put these two pieces together. They're not ready for it yet. We can talk about that afterwards. So let's get started converting a single depth image into a volume. So this is from CVPR last year. The kind of motivation for this is if you're a robot looking at a scene like this and you want to understand where and how to grasp things in this kitchen, if you have the ability to take multiple views, right, multiple images or depth images, then obviously there are lots of ways to fuse that information together and get a 3D shape, telling our robot, where to reach. However, most robots, when they're standing looking at a scene, they have a single view. They don't have multiple views. And so for them, when they look at the scene, this is what they get. They're getting a depth image like this with lots of holes because obviously the objects are sort of occluding the rest of themselves. And that leaves us sort of uncertain where to grasp and if you're a robot navigating through a room, where to move. And we would like to figure out the rest of the scene. We would basically like to get the kind of output you get if you had multiple views, but only given this single input depth image. So you'll figure out, obviously, that we'll be using the multiple inputs for training purposes, and then we'll throw them away at test time. Now, naturally, there are some alternative approaches to this. You could say, I'll just scan all the objects that might come up. Anything that I might need to grasp, I'll make sure I have a 3D model of it. I know what it looks like. I know its shape. And I'll just try to match that to that kind of messy single depth image that I started with. And that works fine. Well, it's not easy, but there are a few solutions for it, as long as you're only picking up and interacting with objects and scenes that you've seen before, so familiar objects. Other approaches include looking at symmetry, so you get a partial scan of an object. If you can figure out, and this is quite fiddly, if you can figure out sort of the central axis, then you might be able to revolve the front surface and try to reconstruct the rest of the shape. Now, that, of course, depends on making sure that you're picking up symmetric objects and that process of estimating the center of rotation. So symmetry is a little bit brittle, except for certain shapes. ShapeNets was specifically going after kind of semantic scenes and trying to do completion. Again, we're in the scenario of reconstructing objects that are from familiar classes, and so we do compare to ShapeNets a bit, but in the end, it is a very kind of constraining situation. You have to be dealing with scenes that you've already kind of analyzed and trained on before. And then there's Zhang's method, which kind of has this nice heuristic, which says that most objects are convex. And so if you could isolate in your depth image which objects go together, then you could fit kind of a convex bounding volume and just label everything inside of that convex bounding volume as occupied, and there you have a volume reconstruction of the scene. And so we compare against Zhang. But you have to do this segmentation. You have to figure out which depth pixels go together to then do that convexity, apply that convexity heuristic. The thing that we really liked from Kristen Grauman's group, from Kim and Grauman, was this 2D, all 2D kind of insight that they had, which was that even if you've trained on one class and you move over to a completely different class, if they were doing silhouettes and segmentations, there's a lot in common. I mean, it's not always going to be that every car maps to every sheep or a person to a bottle, but if you train on a class of objects, the silhouettes are not so different. They just need a little bit of tweaking, a little bit of adjustment to be useful in a completely different setting. And that's kind of the insight we brought to 3D. And so here we'll start off with a nice simple example, kind of a blocky shape and a roundish shape. And already, if you saw this as a depth image, you should be thinking, oh, it's blocky on the front. You know, it probably doesn't extend backwards forever. Maybe it's blocky on the back as well. You know, maybe if it's yay tall, it's not going to be sort of minusculely, you know, super thin. So you probably have some kind of priors on what you think the shape could be in the back. So we'll take this as an example. Imagine that we're going to take a 2D slice through it. So through this, just imagine like a horizontal slice through this. So now we still have our cylinder and our block there, right? And we're just looking at voxels. Now, of course, this is the ground truth, right? When you actually point your connect at this scene from the bottom, right, then you just see the front surfaces and you don't know what's happening in the back. So that gray area is unknown to us. Now, in our process, both at training and then at testing, what we do is we run through the visible surface points and pick them at random, and we say, okay, there is a surface point, For that surface point, we're going to compute some feature representation by looking at its neighborhood. And this is our description of our input. For that input, then, we're going to train a random forest, a structured forest, in fact, for regressing an output, or selecting, really, an output voxelet. So what you see here are these little boxes. They are patterns of how we think the back of that sampled point should look. So let me kind of illustrate that. Right, we had this gray zone surrounding this point. So it was gray in the back, it was white in the front because we could see past that point. But now what we've done is we've inserted the winning structured prediction here that says, behind that point we've trained and seen that normally there's a bit of space that's occupied followed by a bit of space that's empty. And so we plaster that into our output canvas. We'll repeat that process with a different sample point, insert a new prediction, and keep going. So we will just accumulate a bunch of these until we have this kind of volumetric estimate of what we think the backs of this depth image look like. So if you want to see this in 3D, right, you'd have a scene like this. The color is not available to our algorithm. We just use the depth image as our descriptor, right? So it can work at nighttime as well. And we take our sample point. Take the sample point, make a descriptor around it, query, retrieve a voxelet. So now you can see it's a kind of a cuboid representation of what's occupied, what's not occupied. And here we're actually going to transform it. So it's in a canonical orientation, but we're going to transform it so its normal agrees with the surface normal of our sampled point in the image. And that's actually kind of a useful insight and trick. So then we paste that back in and sample another point, now the red point, paste in the voxelet that goes with that, repeat until you have basically accumulated enough of these. Now I mentioned the one trick, which is this reorienting of the voxelets, right? That way you don't have to have every shape at every orientation, right? It is still a random forest, and even if it was a neural network, still before HNets, they couldn't deal with rotation. The other insight is instead of talking about it in terms of voxels, which is what I was doing, just think of them as sine distance functions, so truncated sine distance functions. And that actually works much better. So you have still this notion of what's in and what's out, but at any time you just have to evaluate the zero crossings to figure out that surface representation. But you also kind of know that the function means that you have points that know how far away they are from a surface. And so that helps. Yes?
The normal only locks down two of the rotation.
Exactly right. Yes, so the, let's see, do I have that? No, I don't have that here. The normal only locks down 2 degrees of freedom, and so the third one is we align the voxelets to, we have a notion of what is up. So we keep the same up vector for all of them. That's exactly right. And we went after tabletop objects in the first place, so that assumption holds, right? It wouldn't hold for other scenarios, you know, satellite images types of things. Absolutely right. Now, to train this, we kind of set out and said, oh, well, you know, what data sets are available? Just download something and it'll be great. And Michael Furman had already, so this is the lead author on this, now a postdoc in my group, he kind of set out and then overshot. So he actually maintains the RGBD data set sort of listing and repository. So if you search for RGBD data sets, his page comes up because he catalogs them and tells you like how big each one is and whether it has color or not and whether it is focused on people or tabletops or outdoor or indoor. Anyway, we knew authoritatively that the data didn't exist that we needed. And so we ended up having to capture our own data and simply it was a connect a bunch of tabletop objects and capturing lots of connect images and fusing them together. So we had our ground truth. We knew what some shape looked like from all angles, and we could take any one of those depth images as a potential input to our system where the rest of the fusion was kind of the desired output. Now, we did this pretty carefully to make sure that we had disjoint sets so that nothing in the test set, no objects in the test set, ever appeared in the training set. So you shouldn't see the same objects. You will see a box and a box, but they won't be the same box. They won't be hopefully if it's a cereal box, it'll be like a raisin box at best, you know, different proportions. It is actually fairly hard to come up with lots of tabletop objects that are completely disjoint from each other, but we're pretty happy that we've accomplished that. And so our results are based on that kind of separation. So when testing the system, we don't use the RGB input. So that's just for us to visualize what's going on. We do use that single depth image as an input. And then on the bottom right, I'll show the results. So there's our computed volume representation. And I'll spin that around in a second. In the lower left, we have the ground truth. So what would happen if you had all, whatever it was, 200 to 300 depth images fused together. So as you see, it's not perfect, but it is pretty good. It gets the boxes being boxy, the bottles being bottle-like. The floor is introduced here artificially. So again, we know the top and the bottom, and so it's just a heuristic algorithm that introduces the floor. Compare that to Zeng, which actually has the segmentation of all the objects, right? And we're still looking better. One of the reasons this scene is so cool, and this one is as well, is in the depth image, these objects are actually occluding each other. So it's not just a single, like, oh, see an object, fit a round shape, you're done. You're seeing an object, and you're seeing sort of a hovering set of points, and you're having to complete the back and the bottom and the sides as well. So there's a lot of sort of unknowns when we send in one of these depth images. And the system is, I'd say, faring pretty well on the intended class. Now, besides just looking at this qualitatively, we also needed to evaluate. Oh, yes, sorry.
So the representation you get is some sort of estimated probability that a given voxel is, so because you have overlapping things that you put on top of each other, right?
Yeah.
So how do you end up with sort of whether it's in or out from that?
What we have is a signed distance function being projected. So each return from the random forest is a signed distance function. So each point that you evaluate in 3D, you can say if it's near or far from zero. Or if it's positive or negative, that means
then,
if you're inside or out.
Then you have overlapping ones, so then you average that for each?
So we're averaging. Oh. And averaging isn't that smart. It leads to some kind of smoothing that we're not happy about. But let's say taking small steps away from averaging without being too clever, we didn't get improvements. And so that is something I would hope to improve, but we couldn't find like an easy way. It was sort of a nice plateau where you'd have to climb quite a bit more to get something smarter for fusing.
And then for the images on the previous slide, so then you're just thresholding that function? Is that the...
Yes, so you yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So for numerical analysis, to be apart from the qualitative, we had to come up with our own kind of scheme for scoring ourselves, because you know the predecessors had said, well, you know, it's kind of neat, isn't it? And we needed to put numbers to it. So we said, okay, well, we're going to take everything inside the camera frustum. You know, only we're going to only evaluate points inside of that, and we're going to define the room extents. So somehow we know sort of the wall and the floors. And so only points inside of that and behind the connect scan, because the points in front of the depth image, obviously we know those are empty, so no points for getting that right. And so this is the evaluation region, is what's happening inside of that. So you can look at intersection over union, that's really kind of the main one. And so you know, numerically we win on IOU and on recall. We don't win on precision, although I think that precision is, we could discuss that a little bit. Also, the baselines that we compare against have the ground truth segmentation. They know that someone has gone in and said these depth points correspond to a separate object. That's a bottle. We don't say it's a bottle. Well, no, for these algorithms, we don't say it's a bottle. And so then you can do a bounding box fit to just those points. And every object is sort of pre-segmented for us. And so that's how the baselines work. And we still come out ahead for these types of scenes. Now, if we move away from desktop scenes, which is not what we were intending initially, right? Everybody was kind of interested to say, oh, you know, would this work for indoor scenes, for kind of NYU type of scenes? And so we were curious too. The problem is there's really no training data available for it, because we want to see the objects from the front and the back. And so there was Guo and Derek Hoyam had made this kind of synthetic version of NYU. So this data set is, you know, quite a lot of effort went into it. But we used that to train. So we would still take the real depth images as input from NYU, but then we would use that kind of blocky version as the training data of the volume occupancy. And so here you can see that the results are still better than Zhang. They're still better than the competition. And you can kind of see that the robot would know how to navigate to move behind the bed and between that and the wardrobe. And so there's sort of enough information to operate. I wouldn't say it's a very clean result yet and could still be improved. We can still tell that there's an empty space inside, cavity inside the bathtub. You certainly get a lot more information than just from your raw depth image or from Zhang et al. Because naturally, you know, Zhang, it's hard to segment a scene where, you know, there's a bathtub. You segment that and say it's a convex shape. So it's not surprising that Zhang isn't able to do very well there. So we come back and say, okay, so how much have we really improved things? Now we've got a single image compared to using multiple images. And so here on the bottom right, you're seeing, you're going to see our volume prediction for a single depth image. In the lower left, you're going to see increasing numbers of depth images being fused together. And so that's a single frame. And so obviously, you know, if there's only one frame available, you know, we're clearly the winners. But then even as you increase the number of inputs, if you're just fusing the depth images, it takes a while before this result starts looking like our result. So at frame 38, you know, you could kind of say it's kind of close-ish, but really it would help to keep going past this point to get a smoother result, a cleaner result, more like our voxlets that we get from a single image. We come back to our kitchen example, and so we had this single depth image, and now using this algorithm, right, we can complete that. And it improves most of the objects. Notably, though, it reveals the limitation of if the glass part of the coffee maker wasn't captured, it's not going to get fixed by this algorithm. Right? The volume is still missing, so there's still a gaping hole there. Right. Okay. So some future opportunities for this part of the work, right, is maybe... Oh, sorry, yes.
If you have, say... one object in front of another one, so the bottom half of it's occluded.
Yes.
Then how are you reconstructing that with your normal? I'm thinking of like the bottom half of a box or something. It seems like you would never reconstruct that.
Yeah. We had to train voxlets that were. We have two types of voxlets. We have ones that are just regular ones that I've described, and the other ones are the hovering voxlets. So they're basically like things that you might see. And how to complete that would go down, that would complete down to the ground.
I see. So you'll have a voxlet that says there's this thing around it, and then a different type that...
Yeah, so if the normal voxlets, if you think the normal voxlets as designed to tell you what sits behind a surface point, these voxlets are designed to tell you what sits below a surface point.
Okay.
Yes?
Does that make an assumption though that everything is sitting on the table?
It does assume that everything is, yes, that's right. In addition to the orientation, we've paid that price already. We said, we assume we know the up, we assume there's a ground, and I guess this tells us we don't know where it is, so we don't know how high it is. That's why I'm kind of hesitating.
So when you've got the head,
yeah.
You haven't projected down from the widest point to the table.
When we have the head, like the head is sitting behind something.
Well, just even if the head was by itself,
yeah.
At some point you've got a surface normal for here, and you've not projected the straight down, like, you know, the path beneath that,
yeah.
It changes as it goes down. I guess you've got quite a complicated... description of what can be beneath the surface point.
So our voxlets are not just a ray along the line, they are a volume. And so if I visualize for you this completed scene, you would see a sprinkling of surface points that were used, not a dense every depth pixel was visited and used to make a prediction. So when we have these voxlets, you have a whole set of shapes. It's a pretty big block of voxels sitting behind it that we're predicting and saying on or off, or sign distance. And so it is that's why it goes down, it goes back, to some extent, and left and right. It is sort of a sizable chunk of space that we're explaining with that.
Right.
Yeah. So the we swept the parameter of how big the voxlets, these representations should be, and sort of not surprisingly, there's a kind of a sweet spot that if you're doing tabletop objects, you want the voxlets to be sort of big enough to kind of cover. I'm kind of guessing here at the number, but like a third of the shape of the whole object. But we found that it wasn't that sensitive, so that's why we have some objects, we have scenes where you have a variety of objects, big ones and little ones, and sort of one size was pretty much okay, because we had a variety. We automatically determined the voxlets, obviously. We determined that from the training set. And the voxlets are also compressed, so we ended up doing PCA to reduce the dimensionality of them, because they're very high dimensional, so we kind of reduced the alphabet, so the random forest isn't doing like this massive search. It's a little bit simplified. Yes?
Did you look at having different sizes of voxlets combined together?
Like forcing them to span the space of sizes? No, we didn't. It's a sensible thing to try to cope with variety of sizes. I agree. Yes, we've started going towards using a neural net representation to try to discover the voxlets, and so that's kind of work in progress. I'll skip over the future work, but you get the idea. There are new data sets coming online, synthetic and real, and the code for the system is code and data are available online if anyone is interested. So I wanted to talk about the other single view problem that we're dealing with, and that is namely color to depth. So for indoor scenes, we've got Kinect scans. For outdoor scenes like this, things can be tricky. So our intention is to convert a color image like this into a depth image like this, where hot means close and cold means far away. So the problem itself is typically been approached in a supervised fashion. So meaning, it's sort of obvious, but meaning you take a color input image and you have some ground truth depth image that you wish to estimate, and you set up some kind of model that you train, and when the model spits out a depth image, right, you compare that to the ideal depth image, and you penalize if it gets the wrong answer, right, until the model is trained and you're happy. So that is the way Saxena did it with Make3D, and Derek Hoyam did it with Photo Pop-Up. And after they did these things, which were just amazing, they were so cool, converting a color image into depth information, I took up the mantle and thought, oh, great, let's try this. Let's take more training data and try other scenes. And, for various reasons, it didn't work. And it wasn't clear to me why it didn't work. It wasn't clear if it was because of the quality of the depth data that I was using as supervision, or maybe the capacity of the models that we were using, for learning this mapping from color to depth. Now, the capacity problem obviously has changed a little bit. So now people are using CNNs as the model. And so there's been a rash of papers. So Eigen and Fergus obviously kind of kicked this off again. So this, notice there's a bit of a gap in years here, when maybe I probably wasn't the only one struggling. And a number of other papers now have looked at this and said, oh, let's put a neural network in there to do that mapping. And the results were definitely motivational. But they're not amazingly different. They're not a huge step forward, as big as you would think. And so we look back at the data. So most people are using Kitty data for these types of problems now. And you think, well, great, Kitty is collecting color, reasonably high quality images. And depth, this is a pretty expensive setup. So can you tell what's wrong with this depth image? besides the fact that it's missing a boss, which is pretty bad, it's also got this car superimposed. So the way they did the cars for Ground Truth, this is the Ground Truth that you're seeing on the bottom. They went onto the internet and found models of cars, tried to match the same make and model as close as possible, and then they manually inserted meshes, so those handmade meshes, into the scene to sort of so that not every moving object. So they have a lot of moving objects that are missing. So people, pedestrians, buses, but the cars are usually captured, right? Because they've made sure, they've kind of curated that to make sure it's there. Now, on the surface, this is pretty tragic. But actually, the moving objects don't happen that much. The road, the static part, buildings and things. There's still enough there that the networks can learn. I kind of wanted us to continue with depth images. We've got the technology, right? But Clément, the PhD student, he wouldn't listen, so he wanted to go outside. I mean, he's French, you see. And so he wanted to go outside, and he said, look, there are all these cameras now coming out, increasingly technology available that gives you stereo. So you have two color images. You don't have a depth sensor necessarily. Maybe you do sometimes, but you definitely can get pretty cheap stereo footage. Why don't we work with that? And so Z et al. Had this system. They were trying to generate sort of the other view, so to convert mono to stereo. And they called it unsupervised, and it's a little bit unfair to call it unsupervised, but let's roll with it, right? So the Z method also, this now translates to what we did. They said, right, you can get a left and a right image, and you can talk about it not in terms of depth, but maybe we talk about it as disparity, right? It's just a scaled inverse of depth. And now you can talk about shifting of pixels, right? How, instead of talking about absolute depth, it's about how far does the pixel from the left image, does that same pixel shift? How much is it offset to map to the right image? And so it's just a horizontal shift if you've rectified your images. And so it's a very sort of simple problem. It's our classic stereo problem. But by having left and right, you can go back to our original setup and say, oh, I want to learn to predict, not depth, but I want to learn to predict disparity such that I can reconstruct the other image. And Garg et al. Did the same thing, actually. So they followed in the footsteps of Deep3D. So this is Garg. This is from Ian Reed's group in Australia, right? And so let me kind of illustrate the common parts of this. And also, this is now pretty much explaining our model. So we still have a color input. This is a left input. And we have a right output. Instead of a depth that we're trying to explain, we have a ground truth right image that we're trying to explain. We still have a model that we're going to train. And the model is going to help convert our input into a disparity. Not a depth, but we know there's a nice simple inversion to convert from disparity to depth. Now, when we output that disparity, we still can't compare it to the ground truth right image. But we can synthesize a new right image based on that disparity. We can take the pixels from the left image, shift them according to the disparity map, and synthesize a new right image. Check if the synthesized matches the real right image, right? And if it does, great. Hopefully that means your disparity there in the middle is correct. It's not entirely correct. We'll find out in a moment. But it is that's the idea. So your loss function is now just on color similarity between your real and generated right images. And we have to give our label to our disparity, right? This is actually a right disparity. So it's the disparity, because there's a lot of left and right in this talk, you see. It's the disparity that maps pixels from the left image to generate a right image. Now, there's a slight problem with that. The problem is, I've come to you, this algorithm, I said, here's a left image, give me a depth. And it gives us, if we invert that R depth image, I said, give me a depth for the left image, and it gives me a depth for some other image, right? For the right view. It's not what I wanted, right? I wanted a depth image that goes with this left image. And so we have to flip things around a little bit. So we instead compute a left disparity from the left image, right? I'm just going back and forth. And we're going to sample from the right image at training time only to then synthesize a fake left and compare it to the real left. Okay, so hopefully you see it's not a shell game. I've just done a regular substitution, right? But the payoff is now when you give me a left image, I'm going to get an along the way a left disparity, which I can then infer to give you a left depth image, a depth that matches your input image. The right only served for training purposes, right? And if I use its pixels, shift them according to this disparity, synthesize the left, and I'm happy with that. Great. At test time, obviously that's not there. I can still produce disparities that I can invert. Yes?
Just out of curiosity, did you try training a kind of an autoencoder of some variety to go from the left to the right and seeing what internal representation it built?
No, we didn't.
Okay.
It is an interesting idea. Not trivial, but interesting to explore, yes. So with that approach, we have kind of replicated what Garg had done, and this is the result. Now, we got excited because we said, it's kind of, we're on the scoreboard now, you know, we're kind of making progress, but it's not great. You have a lot of these kind of cloning or ghosting kind of problems. And our result, ultimately, that we achieved looks more like this, right? So if you compare theirs versus ours, there's a bit of improvement. So we have to come back here and see what was going wrong. And my summary of it is, this is all I've done is just shifted I've just stretched the old diagram down a little bit, right? So we had the same left disparity being generated, and we're going to use the right for synthesizing our other view. The problem is that when you have that you can synthesize a left image. Let's just go ahead here. I'll go back. You can synthesize a left image like this one, even while getting the disparity slightly wrong. For large regions of uniform texture, you could get the disparity quite a bit wrong and still generate a realistic looking left image. And actually, I'd encountered this before when I was doing compression, right? There were algorithms designed, this is hardware actually, designed for, this is kind of maybe slightly tangential, algorithms designed to do MPEG-4 compression, which would try to do optical flow. But they didn't need to do correct optical flow. They didn't actually have to tell you where every pixel moved to from frame to frame. They just had to come up with a plausible way of reconstructing frames by encoding an image and then where it should move, where the pixel should move to later. So there are these sort of cheats, and the problem was that the network was learning kind of the path of least resistance, how to generate a left image without actually getting the disparity right. So what we did is we made the network work harder. It still has to produce the left disparity, but we made it also produce the right disparity. We ran the two processes in parallel, so it has to produce both a right and a left. Notice, right, it's always using, to make that left image, it's using pixels from the right, and to make that right image, it's using pixels from the left. You got to keep track of your left and right indices here. And then we compare that, so we can say, okay, what's the loss on the reconstruction? So you have to get both images right, which is not trivial. It means that also, it gives us an opportunity to compare the disparities. And while you might get the disparity kind of right or close to reasonable by accident, it's hard to accidentally produce two disparities that agree with each other, that basically are saying, yes, this is the right depth for that object, for that point, in the same way. So it's easy to be wrong in different directions. It's hard to be wrong in exactly the same direction. And so this extra loss really helped us quite a bit. There's actually a third term, so this is our loss overall, right? It's based on the appearance matching of the generated images. It's based on the consistency, this third term that I've just mentioned, the left-right consistency. In the middle, we also have a smoothness loss. So we're saying we want the disparities to be reasonably kind of smooth, points as islands. Yes?
You have to register the two disparities then?
Yes. So our transformer, yeah. So there's a little bit more to discuss in our network. We transform the disparities just like we transform the pixels It's the same process, though, actually. So it takes the matrix, and it's the same transformation. So the disparity is being used to move... One disparity mapping is used to map a hypothesized disparity. Yes, it's pretty simple as long as you keep track of the indices. Our results then, you see those at the bottom, and you see Garg's kind of the state of the art in the middle there. And hopefully you see that ours are looking a little bit more in focus. You know, you get the shapes shaped correctly, at least a little bit closer to right. And it's true across different scenes. These are all driving scenes. These are all outdoors. And then we evaluate with and without our left-right consistency check. So you can kind of see the difference between the top and the bottom there, or sampling points, you know, from a given scene. So hopefully the right version of the blue square and the red and the green should all look better. Sometimes it makes very little difference, like here in the middle, but usually it helps a little bit also. Our smoothness term, we use that on top of Deep 3D because that was a previous method that was competitive for a while. And that made a huge difference. So actually, if you're going to use Deep 3D, definitely add the smoothness because that improves you from the sort of the top color map here to the middle one. But then ours with this left-right consistency and the other ingredients is actually better still. I won't go into the numbers, but we win. The thing maybe to say here is people got into this and the data sets that exist, so K is for kitty, CS is for cityscapes. It got kind of Wild West-ish in terms of different people using different splits of the data and how they crop their results, and some people using like sometimes the left, sometimes the right image. So kind of bringing order to all of this was tricky. Also, different people reported different criteria, different sort of calculations for quantifying their results. So we just did them all. So we got all the data sets for this problem that we could get, used all of the criteria that existed, and evaluated all of them. And we like for like, we win. So if we train on Kitty like everyone else did, we have better superior scores. If we train on cityscapes and Kitty, then we get even better scores. There's a slight talking point there on the stereo version of ours where you actually keep both inputs, but that's not, let's not talk about that now. We just deal with one input. There's also Kitty, the what we call the eigen split. So in fact, the way he split the data, he's only using, for testing, he's only... Only 5% of the pixels are being evaluated for depth, and so it's an interesting metric to use. And so here we're also coming out ahead even without the post processing, but certainly with an ounce of post processing that I can explain offline if needed. There's also a question of how do we generalize. So if you train on these driving scenarios, we do well. How well do we do on these scenes of Stanford campus, for instance, with Make 3D. And so in the top of the box, you see all the asterisks indicate algorithms that are supervised, fully supervised, and trained on Make 3D. Make 3D doesn't have left and right pairs, so we just trained on Kitty, and that's how we built our system. So numerically, we come out less well, right? So it's not, the story isn't as happy for us here. Although I would argue, with post-processing, our number here at the bottom are not far off of sort of Karsh's methods from Illinois. But then if you look at the results visually, I would say I'm less embarrassed, basically. We didn't have access to domain data that's relevant. We didn't have supervision. Our results are there on the far right. Here you've got the input scene, sort of the two, the top and the bottom. I would say that qualitatively, we're not so bad. I think there's a question of how much we trust the ground truth data here. But anyway, I'm not saying it generalizes splendidly, but for outdoor scenes like Kitty, we've kind of seen scenes like this. I think the algorithm stands a chance. In essence, you could think of what we're doing as a kind of indirect object recognition, right? If you see a person and they're about yay big in your color image, then they're probably about yay far away. And I think that kind of applies also to other objects that we're seeing. We tried every kind of data set, so maybe I'll just show you the video. The cityscapes data set comes up first, right? So you're seeing two outputs at the same time, so just to kind of get through it faster. I mean, we're processing frame after frame, so each frame is processed individually. There's no temporal coherence in the algorithm, so any kind of inconsistencies would appear as flicker. This should look familiar to some of you. This is driving around Cambridge.
In John Wynn's car.
Right? In John Wynn's car. This was one of these is John Wynn's car. The other one was a rental car because John wasn't available that day. But yes, and this is just walking around. So this is slightly more freeform. Going into the park and things that weren't necessarily in Kitty or cityscapes. So basically, we've tested on every scene we could find, and the results look reasonably happy for us. Let me go and continue here. Yep. There we go. So the code is available online today. We had to put some licensing information in there because we have now been filed and actually gotten sort of the initial filing, the UK approval. And we're trying out the algorithm for other settings, so capturing other data sets. The occlusion boundaries are, I would say, the place for the greatest improvement. So if we have a second, we have a second, right?
Yeah. One.
Here we've got a single input color image. 600, great. So we take a color image from the Kitty data set, and this is the depth that we're estimating for that scene. And now we're just wobbling the head kind of back and forth in a prescribed fashion. And so you can kind of see that occlusion boundaries aren't, they're sharp enough, but when we try to generate other views, so I go back to the color version, you can see what I call skirts, right? That we don't necessarily just chop the depth discontinuity. We have a bit of a smooth transition that the network is outputting. So some of these objects that should, like the posts on the road, that should be nice and sharp, are leaving a little bit of a they're kind of a gradual transition from foreground to background. And you can jump around, you can go anywhere in the Kitty data set and see the results. Also, the left and right extreme boundaries are harder because during the training data, every input is paired with another, like a left input is paired with a right input. And so that means that you have kind of, you have depth information or the parallax information for things in the middle of the scene. But for things on the periphery, you don't have the other camera doesn't see that, and so you can't. It's hard to train for those. So in a way, you might not want just left and right. You might want sort of an array of cameras, spanning a beam, the width of a car, if you're going to drive around with it. And I mean, if people want to play, you can come up later and look at cityscape scenes and evaluate. Evaluate the results, but I'm pretty happy with all of the frames. There aren't sort of secret bad ones that we're hiding. Okay, so with that, thank you very much for your attention.
I think we have plenty of time for questions. So,
yeah, hi, Sebastian.
A simple technical one, perhaps it was addressed not in your work but early already, but it's how in this, when you do the remapping, so you output a disparity map,
yeah,
and then there's a simple function that maps it to the other view. But is that differentiable, or do you have to play any tricks there?
Yes, yeah. So we used the Oxford method for transforming it so that it was differentiable, and that was it was a point of contention because in Garg's paper, they initially said theirs wasn't differentiable. And we thought, oh, that's why ours is so much better. But actually, theirs was differentiable, in fact. So it helps. You have to have it. But that isn't the secret sauce for us, as it turns out. Yes?
In the video of the roundabout, it looked like there was a lens artifact being interpreted as death. How do we deal with that? Or is that an issue?
Yeah, I totally agree it's an issue. I wouldn't want to drive around in a car that suddenly says, big vertical object in the middle of the road. It wasn't, you know, I could weasel out of this question and say, oh, it wasn't in the training data. You know, it's your fault for not putting it in the training data. But the fact is, it's very hard, right? If it looks like a shape and it's a per frame algorithm, then it's doomed, right? It's going to think your Tesla or whatever is going to slam on the brakes because there it is. I can go back to the video if someone wants to see the frame he's talking about, but it is bad, right? It suddenly thinks there's an object right in front of you. Yes?
So the ground truth for the last stuff you showed there was based on a binocular view, and then you were... Is that what you're doing there?
So the ground truth I was showing for the Make 3D... that's the most recent ground truth I showed.
Yeah.
So that is from a laser scanner, I think. So I think.
But in the walk around stuff you were doing in Cambridge, that was comparing binocular view, so a two image view, a left and right image view, as the ground truth versus a single image view. Was that the?
I was. Yeah. So for the Cambridge data set, it's just single view input images, and so. So we were just testing on that and generating depth images from those. Indeed, the training for that was left-right views from Kitty and Cityscape. So we used the bigger training set for that result. Yes?
Okay. So in stereo, it's pretty well known that if you have very high-res images, everything becomes easier because you get, like, pick up on microtextures and so on for matching. So is that the hope that... Because everything in the end is just a feed-forward neural network that you could apply this to whatever 16 megapixel images and everything will just magically work and all the depth occlusion boundaries and everything will be like amazing. Or what are the real bottlenecks or obstacles in just collecting a bunch of data?
We've stood up and said, and I guess I'm being recorded now to saying, yeah, it's about getting large quantities of data, and that it is. Less about resolution in our case, and more about recognition. So you want scenarios that look familiar, because it's not a matching process. It is more about familiarity that this general appearance. And we are multi-scale. This whole network is implemented at multiple scales. So it is more about the context of the shape rather than the texture of the shape. So higher resolution images. Would not be my first choice for expanding the data set, but greater variety, large quantity of images, different viewing angles, that's our top priority.
Yes, talking about viewing angles, it looks like those pictures are taken from a higher viewing vantage point than the training data which is mounted.
I wouldn't be surprised, actually, now that you say that, because this was done, person walking around campus, Stanford campus, whereas the driving ones are mounted in the car.
It just looks like you think stuff is closer. Well, you're basically right, but your depth, yours comes out.
Ah, you think we have a bias because of the viewing angle?
Yeah.
Ah, I hadn't even thought of that.
How do you know there's no color bar?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's our secret.
So the entire scene could just be a scaled down world, right?
Yeah. It's absolutely the question that I'm always asking, right? Because are we looking at a Barbie world or a real world, right? Because it could be just a conversion factor in scale.
Yeah, yeah.
And so a limitation that we have right now is that because we do this left and right and they go through parallel, all our training data has to come with the same disparity. And so...
It's a sort of camera setup.
Exactly, it's that fixed camera setup. So we can pump through... Easily cheap to get data, but all the data has to come from the same stereo rig setup.
And is that always mounted at the same height in practice?
So it's not. So Cityscapes and Kitty have different heights of mounting, not drastically different, but one's on top of the roof, the other one is sort of lower down in the frame of the car. But we are, and we've adapted the baseline, so we take one data set and re-render the images so that it matches the other, so that we could put both into the same network. But we're working on that, and so that is actually, that's kind of a preview. It's working, right, to go different, to have welcome data sets of different baselines. But the question of height, I think, is interesting, because if we're biasing based on height, that will be a problem, right? One could argue that, you know, if we were to start combining multiple frames to take multiple depth images, sorry, multiple color images as input, we could start adapting, you know, a bit in terms of scale and say, okay, well, I've got some kind of Procrustes problem. I've got a prediction for the depth. Can I match that and twist it to map to this particular scene? Yeah, I hadn't thought about it. It's a good question. Yes?
Would it be really difficult to have a sort of up-down version of your left-right that you were talking about?
Yeah,
earlier?
Yeah. So we are thinking about that in part. So I'm showing you all my cards. Because I would like to do 360, because that's when you really have trouble doing stereo, right? You know, it's just physically difficult. But the only way you can do stereo with 360 is exactly as you say, top-down. So... And then we have to do that exactly. I can't say it's like coming because we haven't started it, but we are kind of planning it. Yeah. Yes.
So in the first part of your talk, you were focused on single image, but there's sort of nothing inherent about it that has to limit it to single image, right? Like
that's
you could
right.
do a better job of reconstructing in the connect fusion scenario as well, right?
That's right, yeah.
And did you guys look at that at all, or is that something new?
We stopped just shy of it. Basically, we tried doing computing a descriptor based on two images that were kind of nearby, and it wasn't like it seemed that if they were really close to each other, the two input images, then it didn't really help, obviously, because it wasn't giving a lot of new information. And then as we got further away, it did help, but then
the baseline was getting way better.
Right, exactly. So that there you're yeah. The,
so as you
it's
get
getting
more
away
images,
from you, right?
The gains go
yeah.
down pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. So we talked about what we have talked about is a like a next best view planning system, because that would be kind of interesting. There are standard metrics for that we could just use and say, all right, for next best, where does my robot go to get the next best view, and there are winners and losers and benchmarks. But we don't have a platform, like a physical platform for capturing, and so we could do it in simulation.
I mean, you could take your existing data and pick another view.
Yes, exactly. That's what I meant. Yeah.
Oh, okay,
pretend that our robot went to that angle and then.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you meant simulated vision or graphics.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other burning questions?
I'm available offline as well.
Yeah,
so.
Of course. Yes. Let's thank Gabe again.
Thank you very much.